Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud, and it is all about holding people accountable. It's the divine nature of our Constitution. We the people actually have it ingrained and galvanized in that Constitution and protected. We have a right to hold them accountable. The right of petitioning government for the redress of grievances is the process. It is not a constitutional convention. And we actually have the law on our side that when we've identified somebody that has violated their oath, and ergo they're no longer eligible to be in office, then they must be removed. That's the law of the land. The law does not have mercy built into it. And so, but the problem is that not one state has ever imposed or actually has created a law to enforce the Constitution, which they need to do. But folks, I'm just telling you, if we held our public servants accountable, we would not be dealing with communism amongst us. We would not be dealing with all of this evil government. Oh, but we get these little stipends, and that's not, we get these jobs. And folks, that comes with the devil. Oh, the devil's going to take care of you. And, you know, 99% of everything he's going to give you will not be repugnant. It is the evil that you have to accept that comes with that. And folks, you need to start understanding that the nice things that we have need to go away because government has never been given the authority to do those things for us. So with that, let's dive back into the Constitutional Convention, James Madison's notes. And we've got Sean and Tammy back with us. Welcome back, both of you. Sean, Tammy.
Thank you.
Good to be here, sir. Thank you.
Okay. And so... any go backs at all? Any? None? Hearing none? Not hearing any? Okay. Let's just dive forward. And we're on page, folks, we're on page 178. We're kind of stopping or starting this, if we've covered this already, we're starting the Mr. Gary of Massachusetts when they're talking about admitting new states into the Union. And this kind of, this all cycles around. And you'll notice that for the longest time, this has all been a huge discussion about the potential of bringing states into the Union, as well as, you know, how are we going to manage property regarding representation? Because the South wants their property to be apportioned. In other words, they want representation for their slaves. And so this is going to go on. And we actually had, you know, somebody, I forget who it was before last week, kind of identify that, oh, you know, hey, this whole thing is really about the slaves and that, you know, this is becoming a pretty repugnant idea. They're getting to a point where they're going to actually have to talk about the elephant in the room, where the South is literally going to, and this is when they actually, I think they put their barriers down and start speaking as human beings about what they're really doing to other human beings. And so anyway, and actually, let me remind you the epiphany that happened, because I'm still learning. I didn't realize that the three-fifths rule was actually a rule that was created in the Articles of Confederation, or I should say by Continental Congress. That's where they came up with the three-fifths rule, which is why they basically started injecting it as the three-fifths rule, or this, you know, this resolution by Continental Congress and on some given day of 1783. But anyway, let's move forward and actually... Tammy, why don't you go ahead and start with Mr. Gary's comments regarding this admission of new states, property representation, and so forth. Thank you so much.
Mr. Gary, finding that the loss of the question had proceeded from an objection with some to the proposed assessment to direct taxes on the inhabitants of the states, which might restrain the legislature to a poll tax, moved his proposition again, but so varied as to authorize the assessment on the states, which would leave the mode to the legislature. At this caret, insert the... I'm not really sure what that is. At this caret, insert the words interlined.
Uh-huh. So that's
from the first meeting.
So that's a note from Madison to insert these lines, quote unquote. Okay. Go ahead.
So here's a quote that from the first meeting of the legislature of the U.S. until a census shall be taken, all monies for supplying the public treasury by direct taxation shall be raised from the said several states according to the number of their representatives respectively in the first branch, close quote.
Okay. And so on this varied question, it passed in the affirmative. So in other words, it passed. I could go through the votes, but the southern states, they were all aligned for it. Virginia even aligned for it. And Pennsylvania, actually, Massachusetts, let me confirm this. Massachusetts is one, four. Connecticut, no. New Jersey, no. Pennsylvania was divided, so it didn't vote. And Delaware was a no, and Maryland was a no, and then Virginia, North Carolina, yeah, I guess it's 5-4. It passed by one vote. Okay, so not an overwhelming majority, but now on the motion of Mr. Randolph, go ahead and read this motion, Sean. Thank you.
On the motion of Mr. Randolph, the vote of Saturday last authorizing the legislature to adjust from time to time the representation upon the principles of wealth and numbers of inhabitants was reconsidered by common consent in order to strike out wealth and adjust the resolution to that requiring periodical revisions according to the number of whites and 3/5 of the blacks. The motion was in the words following: but as the present situation of the states may probably alter in the number of their inhabitants, that the legislature of the United States be authorized from time to time to apportion the number of representatives. And in case any of the states shall hereafter be divided, or any two or more states united, or new states created within the limits of the U.S., the legislature of the U.S. shall possess authority to regulate the number a representative in any of the foregoing cases upon the principle of their number of inhabitants according to the provisions hereafter mentioned.
Okay, so see, they're literally laying out the qualifications of new states joining the union, as well as they're maintaining the paradigm, because it says right here that the legislature of the U.S., in other Congress, be authorized from time to time to apportion the number of representatives. So in other words, they didn't need to even put a number in there. The fact that they put in 40,000 originally and then changed that number to 30,000 and affixed it to 30,000 in the Constitution without the language that the legislature of the U.S. be authorized from time to time to apportion the number of representatives, because that language isn't there, that means that the representation ratio of 30-1 is fixed in the Constitution and not changeable. Congress cannot pass an act to say it's going to be this now. The only way they could pass an act was for this language to actually be in the Constitution, that the legislature of the United States be authorized from time to time to apportion the number of representatives. And technically, they would have had to move that from Article 1, Section 2 into Article 1, Section 8, because this would have been a power of Congress, the House of Representatives specifically, because that's the only number that they're really playing with. They don't play with the equal suffrage in the Senate. That number will never change. So anyway, but I think it would still require both houses of Congress, so... where would it originate? I don't know if it would matter, but it's because it's not necessarily dealing with the apportionment of with taxation, where they're going to be taxing people or what have you. So anyway, all right. So that's very, again, the language is still there that Congress has the power to make those changes. So Governor Morris then pipes in, and basically, let's go ahead with this, Tammy.
Mr. Governor Morris opposed the alteration as leaving still an incoherence. If Negroes were to be viewed as inhabitants, and the revision was to proceed on the principle of numbers of inhabitants, they ought to be added in their entire number and not in the proportion of three-fifths. If as property the word wealth was right, and striking it out would produce the very inconsistency which it was meant to get rid of. The train of business and the late turn which it had taken had led him, he said, into deep meditation on it, and he would candidly state the result. A distinction had been set up and urged between the north and the northern and southern states. He had hitherto considered this doctrine as heretical. He still thought the distinction groundless. He sees, however, that it is persisted in, and that the southern gentlemen would not be satisfied unless they see a way open to their gaining a majority in the public councils. The consequence of such a transfer of power from the maritime to the interior and landed interest will, he foresees, be such an oppression of commerce that he shall be obliged to vote for the vicious principle of equality in the second branch in order to provide some defense for the northern states against it. But to come more to the point, either this distinction is fictitious or real. If fictitious, let it be dismissed and let us proceed with due confidence. If it be real, instead of attempting to blend incompatible things, let us at once take a friendly leave of each other. There can be no end of demands for security if every particular interest is to be entitled to it. The eastern states may claim it for their fishery and for their objects as the southern states claim it for their peculiar objects. In this struggle between the two ends of the Union, what part ought the middle states in point of policy to take? To join their eastern brethren according to his ideas. If the southern states get the power into their hands and be joined as they will be with the interior country, they will inevitably bring on a war with Spain for the Mississippi. This language is already held. The interior country, having no property nor interest exposed on the sea, will be little affected by such a war. He wished to know what security the northern and middle states will have against this danger. It has been said that North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia only will in a little time have a majority of the people of America. They must in that case include the great interior country, and everything was to be apprehended from their getting the power into their hands.
Okay, so this is a very long comment about an indictment of how he feels how repugnant this move and shift towards slavery is going to be. And so, because he's telling basically everybody that if you allow the South to do this, then they're going to basically go for obtaining control. Now, and that's one of the reasons why he said, then I will basically vote to ensure that the second house of the legislature, in other words, the Senate in Congress, will actually be equal suffrage. He didn't like that principle, but he said that is the defense against the, you know, this basically what he sees as this evil coming from the South. And so he also lays out here, this is so fascinating, because he lays out here how the South is going to go and continue to pursue this. But he doesn't realize, to be clear, he's advocating that the blacks be fully apportioned. In other words, that the slaves will receive a full apportionment, because he believes that we can't call them, you know, property. And he, you know, that's where he kind of goes into this whole, you know, details of this quagmire. Are they property or are they people? Let's not make the mistake that Continental Congress had done. And let's move forward and get it right by calling them people. But if we do that, then it will create such an advantage that they will basically expand all the new commerce and all the new states in their favor. But that didn't happen. What happened was the three-fifths rule stuck. Governor Morris wasn't happy. I believe Governor Morris still signed the Constitution, but obviously he wasn't going to be happy with it because he had said a few times already, you know, his position on this. Therefore, it actually proves the sentiments that the South and the three-fifths rule was literally capping them, as well as the inability to import slaves. That compromise, because we still haven't hit August, right? August 22nd is when this happens. We're in the middle of July. We're just 5-6 weeks away from the coming to full circle what this compromise over slavery is going to be. And most people would think that the real energy of the Constitutional Convention would have been really over heady things and, you know, just this, you know, I'll call it philosophy of governing and, you know, this really high level of, you know, making a really great government. But the reality, and I hope everybody realizes this, because I think that the advocates in putting a stain on this mark that they're placing on the Constitution, that it was engulfed in favor of slavery, that has got to be the stupidest and most illiterate comment I could ever hear. These men fought and fought and fought, and they still kept at bay the ability for slavery to get a strong foothold by using the three-fifths rule and shutting off the slave trade after 20 years. By placating the South to that degree, it forced the South to, you know, basically have to deal with getting rid of slavery. Nobody thought that there would be this huge violation of the Constitution called the Missouri Compromise, where the federal government was now mandating that all of these states that were joining the Union were going to be slave states, whether they wanted it or not. Wow. And what that did was it basically forced us. So, in other words, if you kind of look at this as good and evil, evil being those who were probably, or not probably, those who were propagating and supporting and were the proponents for slavery as the solution for the United States moving forward. And the other side was, you know, our Creator, Christ, and, you know, the repugnance of slavery and this huge dichotomy that was being created where these two sides were so opposed, and what ended up coming out was good was going to prevail. But you had to think that evil is not going to rest. Evil is not going to just accept the defeat and eventually get rid of slavery. They did everything they could, and even after slavery ended, they still wanted to maintain oppression, and they used the courts to redefine the 14th Amendment. They used the courts to redefine the Constitution and literally start creating rules and laws that were absolutely in defiance of the Constitution to perpetuate this division within America to continue. So if you want to blame anybody, blame those guys in black robes, because they were the ones that opened the doors and, I would say, the windows and doors to hell by allowing America to literally dismantle these protections within the Constitution, to literally preserve the rights of all people and change it to be able to oppress the blacks over the course of the next century. That the Democrats, the communists, all of these people who were all behind all of this, it's all about division and hate. They were basically helping to propel Satan's agenda so that we would still be clouded to this day. Wow. Who would have thought? Well, I'm telling you, our Creator knew what was happening. which is why the 14th Amendment was done the way it was done, and why it had to be attacked by the men in robes. The Black Robe Regiment literally attacked the 14th Amendment and the Constitution so that they could get away with implementing racism and secularism and godlessness in America. And it was incrementally done, boom, 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 like nobody saw it coming because it was so slowly evolving and winding. The racism was pretty quick. But the going secular and godless, you couldn't just start burning Bibles because that would have tipped your hand. So what they did was they started attacking the education system with the Scopes trial and so forth. But anyway, I digress. This is a very powerful paragraph right here. And so now Mr. Butler is probably, because he's from the South, is probably going to open up his heart and, you know, defend himself or basically say, get over yourself. I don't know. Who knows what he's going to say except for Sean, because Sean's going to tell us what he says.
Mr. Butler, South Carolina, the security the southern states want is that their Negroes may not be taken from them, which some gentlemen within or without doors have a very good mind to do. It was not supposed that North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia would have more people than all the other states, but many more relatively to the other states than they now have. The people in strength of America are evidently bearing southwardly and southwesternly.
Ah, good accent. Thank you.
All right. I thought he deserved it.
Yeah, he did. Okay, so Mr. Wilson of Pennsylvania, who he's the one in the ratification debate that exposes how the ultimate compromise will force the southern states to abandon slavery, or that Congress and the changes in the federal government in Congress itself will force it. Either they give it up or Congress will ultimately shift in power, because at this point in time, they couldn't enforce slavery upon states. And I, folks, if you go do the research, and I think, Sean, I think you expressed interest on this. If you start looking at the real research of what people tell you and how they've concocted the history books, that Missouri wanted slavery. But there's absolutely no evidence of that other than the history books itself. There's no newspaper clippings that the people are up in arms that they can't have slavery. Who would actually have the interest of maintaining slavery would be those people who have heavily invested in creating plantations and slavery in Missouri. And when you look at the population of who those people were, because they had the money, these were the people sitting on big cash money because they were coming from the franchises east of them. And everybody else, where it's the sharecroppers or individuals, what have you, were all on their own. They didn't have a lot of money to throw into this, which is why I believe that the admission of Missouri was held off to ensure that the Missouri Compromise would force them in, because it required Congress. Because if you look, what is the compromise of the Missouri Compromise? That all states to the south of Missouri would become slave states. So why was Missouri included in it? Because it was sitting on top of that line. The Mason-Dixon line is the southern boundary of Missouri. And Congress said, okay, we're creating this Mason-Dixon line. Oh, but Missouri has to be a slave state. I mean, they literally had to impose that right up front. Why? Because that's where the money was pushing this. And to find all of these types of artifacts in history are very, very, very difficult. But when you really start going, and the only way you can really find out what the sentiments of the people were, was through the press. And you'll probably find that there may have been an establishment press that was being paid for, sending out propaganda. But when you look out throughout the rest of the state, where the independent press might be actually pushing back against slavery and how this happened and so forth, now you actually would probably start seeing the truth. But the Dred Scott case really provides, to me, irrefutable evidence where, and I'm going to run out of time because I only got a couple seconds. So I'll finish on the Dred Scott case when we come back from this very important break. And it's not a paid break. It's just a promo. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so the Dred Scott case was only a couple of decades after the fact. Now, if slavery was such a important matter for Missouri to become a state, then you would think that the outcome of the Dred Scott case would either be a slam dunk in favor of him being returned to being a slave, or at least it would have been a level of contention to where they would either not be able to come up with a verdict, or the contention would probably lean in favor of him being restored to being a slave. Because the Dred Scott case that was tried in Missouri, a pair of 12 white men unanimously, and if you look at the history of the process of deliberating and so forth, it was pretty quickly done that 12 white men basically said, you're to be a free man, enjoy your freedom. And so that flies in the face of Missouri's gotta have it. As a matter of fact, it was very quickly contested by the state attorney general, who basically appealed that case up to, or actually the whoever the pursuer was got the attorney general. They pursued it up into the Supreme Court, and Taney jumped on it quickly. And Taney basically said, no, Dred Scott, you're going to be a slave. And, oh, by the way, blacks can't vote. They started creating these racial redefining of the laws and so forth in the Constitution before this 14th Amendment. So my point is the courts have already revealed themselves. And I talked about this in my book. If you look at Hamilton and Hamilton's influence over those midnight judges, what ended up happening was there was a huge advancement of Southern judges that went into federal positions in 1800. And if you watch where these judges were coming from that were getting federal appointments, because they typically, the president, I don't know all these, ins and outs of, the legal milieu, this environment, this genre. Who do you suggest? And they were constantly pointing towards Southern and or slave-supporting law lawyers and so forth to become the Supreme Court judge, federal judges, and so forth. This is why the court actually had become such an activist court. This was the direction of Hamilton and his guidance, because he knew that from the Federalist Papers, the courts would be able to take over the government. And in so doing, they were literally undermining and rewriting the Constitution and absolutely wreaking havoc, creating divisive laws and divisive rulings that made everybody scratch their head. This is why in 1821, John Jay Jackson, for speaking for a group of concerned citizens who, you know, thought themselves constitutionalists and they wanted to see the Constitution survive. What they saw was an assault by the courts and other things. They asked him for a copy of his constitutional, his notes on the Constitutional Convention. And that's all in a letter from John G. Jackson to Madison. And Madison's response back was, hey, it doesn't really matter what we thought in the Constitutional Convention, what the Constitution meant. You've got to go to the ratification debates to understand what the Constitution meant to the states at the time of its ratification, because that's all that matters. And so that right there is an indication that when the Missouri Compromise in 1820, you know, came out of the courts, or I should say came out of Congress, and the courts and everybody else was going, yeah, okay, we're okay with that, as well as some of the other rulings that had been coming out, people started scratching their heads going, hey, this is not a good direction. The federal government should not be doing this. Anyway, so now it's Mr. Wilson's shot. And so, Tammy, if you would, let's hear what Mr. Wilson kind of says.
Mr. Wilson, if a general declaration would satisfy any gentleman, he had no indisposition to declare his sentiments, conceiving that all men wherever placed have equal rights and are equally entitled to confidence, he viewed without apprehension the period when a few states should contain the superior number of people. The majority of people wherever found ought in all questions to govern the minority. If the interior country should acquire this majority, it will not only have the right, but will avail themselves of it whether we will or not. We will or not. This jealousy misled the policy of Great Britain with regard to America. The fatal maxims espoused by her were that the colonies were growing too fast and that their growth must be stinted in time. What were the consequences? First, enmity on our part, then actual separation. The consequences will result in the part of the interior settlements if like jealousy and policy be pursued on ours. Further, if numbers be not a proper rule, why is not some better rule pointed out? No one has yet ventured to attempt it. Congress have never been able to discover a better. No state, as far as he had heard, had suggested any other. In 1783, after elaborate discussion of a measure of wealth, all were satisfied, then as they are now, that the rule of numbers does not differ much from the combined rule of numbers and wealth. Again, he could not agree that property was the sole or the primary object of government and society. The cultivation and improvements of the human mind was the most noble object. With respect to this object, as well as other personal rights, numbers were surely the natural and precise measure of representation. And with respect to property, they could not vary much from the precise measure. In no point of view, however, could the establishment of numbers as the rule of representation in the first branch vary his opinion as to the impropriety of letting a vicious principle into the second branch. On the question to strike out wealth and to make the change as moved by Mr. Randolph, it passed in the affirmative.
Okay, so now a second opinion from Pennsylvania talked in favor of supporting equality in the second branch because they saw the power shift of what they're talking about. I mean, so Governor Morris, I believe Governor Morris was from Pennsylvania. Anybody want to correct me on that? Anybody?
You are correct, sir.
Okay. And so, because I've questioned myself, where is it, there it is right there. Yep, Governor Morris. Okay, thank you. Not that I didn't believe you, but I did have the list. I should have had it open anyway. But, okay. Now it's becoming clear that the North is having to take a defensive position in recognizing that we would be set up as a nation that would be fighting wars that would be advantageous for the slave controllers or the slave masters that would basically be controlling government, which is one of the reasons why there was a big pushback by the same in ensuring that the slaves weren't fully represented, because the argument kept on coming up and coming up and coming up, even though they didn't like the ultimate idea of calling, you know, a person, because to the North, they were persons. They weren't property, and that they should have a full representation. But because of what the South was trying to do, they needed, and they basically kind of, I'll just say, they circled their wagons and they rallied around the idea of reducing representation that was proposed by Continental Congress. I thought that they did it, but as it was proposed by Continental Congress, it kind of gave them an out. Now that I see that that's what happened, you know, come on, am I right or not? This gives them an ability to wash their hands of diminishing the souls of these black people who were being considered three-fifths for apportionment purposes. Am I right or am I wrong?
You are correct, sir.
Okay, so it was politically expedient for them to do that because they saw the real and tangible threat that was coming from these Southern states. Okay, so as we move forward and as we kind of dive deeper, on July 14th, we go further into the admission of states. So, Tammy, if you would read Mr. Gary again regarding his comments on the Western country. Go ahead.
Mr. Gary wished before the question should be put that the attention of the House might be turned to the dangers apprehended from Western states. He was for admitting them on liberal terms, but not for putting ourselves into their hands. He will, if they acquire power, like all men, abuse it. They will oppress commerce and drain our wealth into the Western country. To guard against these consequences, he thought it necessary to limit the number of new states to be admitted into the Union in such a manner that they should never be able to outnumber the Atlantic states. He accordingly moved that in order to secure the liberties of the states already confederated, the number of representatives in the first branch of the states, which shall hereafter be established, shall never exceed in number the representatives from such of the states as shall accede to this confederation.
So that's interesting. Then I say that because when you really think about the Western states, you know, we talk about how these guys, you know, thought that they knew the numbers and thought that they were projecting, you know, best. I think that there was a bias towards favoring their control more so than actuality, that when the West started developing, that they would outnumber and outcontrol them. So one needs to think about what is required for a mass of population to occur quickly.
Migration.
Okay, the migration of people, but there's got to be something out there that says, hey, you know, like the gold rush, right? All these freeloaders, you know, quick, get rich quick, let's go to the gold rush. There were a lot of people, but they had to go so far to get there that we created Denver and other spots along the way, right? Okay, but
transportation, well, some form to get there.
Right, it was a very arduous path moving west. The real thing that would have gravitated people into the West quickly, and Chicago was a perfect example, and then there was another example that actually kind of, wow, it's hard to imagine that Chicago was the second largest city in Illinois. But the reason Chicago became the largest city West was because of its factories, because it had the ability to employ people. And so people could go there and get a job, right? When you go out to the West to this, you know, no man's land, well, it is that. I mean, so it's free land practically. And in many of these states, they actually stopped selling the land. The states were literally giving away their land just to get people in there, or the territories were, and that's what they created homestead laws. So the people could literally get free land and come and start growing crops, you know, raising up cattle, sheep, whatever it was that they wanted to do. And when you look at that type of population, it's sparse. That's why the Western lands really started growing slowly, I mean, I think I'd have to pull it up. But I think when we went to the Civil War, from 1820 to the Civil War, I'm going to venture to say we probably only added maybe 10, 12 more states. And so, actually, I need to pull it up. So, guess who's got to do it? Somebody's got to do it. It'll be me. I'll be the one that does it. Statehood order, and there's my spreadsheet for that. Boom. As I look at the going to the Civil War, 1861, there were 34 states. And from the Missouri Compromise, 1820, so there was a total of 10 states that were added to the Union after the Missouri Compromise. And we're talking about 41 years. So what are these guys talking about? How quickly they're going to grow and outnumber us? You see my point? In other words, I think that they were creating an argument to more so for protectionism so that they could maintain their control over the Union than anything else. It was had nothing to do with a true argument that they were going to be quickly outnumbered.
It maybe have something to do with them having more slaves and the slaves having representation. Because if you move out into a vast area, you can have a 100-acre plantation. If you have enough slaves, then one man could have 100 acres, and all of the slaves get counted as representation.
And that was Governor Morris's point, right? Okay, so Governor Morris's point was the same thing. Mr. Gary wasn't bringing that point up at all. And Mr. Gary, I'm not sure whether he cared too much about slavery, because, you know, he wasn't even mentioning that innocuous part of this argument. So as I look at what he's trying to say, I look at it more protectionist. And actually, as things were moving, the shifting of creating the sovereignty in the state house or in the second house was becoming more and more acceptable, where the states would have their sovereignty. Even though the language was in the Constitution, there were still a lot of people that were against it, because we kind of pointed that out, that at this point in time, the state legislature was going to control that state senate. Maybe they didn't have the, I think they did have the language, because Sean, when you read the Constitution, and I think that may be where we left off last, actually, we were in the middle of reading the Constitution, or you were, and I don't think we ever finished that, but the point is that in reading that, they did have in the second Constitution, and so, you know what? My bad. I think we are in August. That's where we should have left off. But what we're exposing right here are really, really critical arguments worth going over one more time. So if you're hearing this for the second time, then my bad. But if you're actually realizing just how important and how pivotal these arguments really, really were, as we're looking at, you know, migrating and trying to finalize the Constitution, there were certain things that had to be done, and we don't see those things happening because the language wasn't there yet. Congress was going to have way too much control. They needed to take that away. They needed to make sure that the slave states were going to be snubbed from being able to maintain a slave trade, on and on. So as we kind of move into the next one, so Mr. King seconded the motion, and then Sean, if you want to go ahead, or yeah, Tammy read Mr. Gary. So Sean, if you would go ahead and read Mr. Sherman and Mr. Gary, what I will do is I will kind of catch us up to August, to where we left off. So go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was looking for what you were talking about. I kind of lost my place. So where are we?
Okay, so we're on Mr. Sherman and Mr. Gary on page 181.
Okay, I got you. Okay. Mr. Sherman thought there was no probability that the number of future states would exceed that of the existing states. If the event should ever happen, it was too remote to be taken into consideration at this time. Besides, we are providing for our posterity, for our children and our grandchildren, who would be as likely to be citizens of new Western states as of the old states. On this consideration alone, we ought to make no such discrimination as was proposed by the motion. Mr. Gary, if some of our children should remove, others will stay behind, and he thought it incumbent on us to provide for their interests. There is a rage for immigration from the eastern states to the western country, and he did not wish for those remaining behind to be at the mercy of the immigrants. Besides, foreigners are resorting to that country, and it is uncertain what turn things may take there. On the question for agreeing to the motion of Mr. Gary, it passed in the negative.
Right. Okay. So, towards the early August time frame, you start seeing, and that's what we were reading, when the Constitution was being kind of reported in Resolutions 1, or actually when I look at it with Mr. Butler, it was still called Resolutions. The Constitution actually started taking true form in August 6th, and we started reading, you know, the Constitution, and we were paying attention to the language, such as the admission of states, such as the numbers of representation. And so one of the things that came up, where we looked at the number and the 30,000 or apportionment and so forth, I believe it was still, and all I'd have to do is look it up, but I believe that at this point in time, they still didn't take the power away from Congress to set what the apportionment would be or how many representatives they would be in control of that number. And so it's only in a later day when they finally get to that point and say, okay, we need to start pulling this stuff back. Now, on August 6th, because this is worth repeating too, this is where they started adding language to the admission of states into the Union, and they actually talk about, and actually, here it is right here. So this is on page 251. It's a jump. I know it's a jump. But if you go to 251, and I believe this is Mr. Rutledge reading all of this. He's going through these resolutions. And so this is section 4 of what article is this? Article 4. Article 4, Section 4, and this is what he says. Section 4, as the proportions of numbers in different states will alter from time to time, as some of the states may hereafter be divided, as others may be enlarged by addition of territory, as two or more states may be united, as states may be erected within the limits of the United States, the legislature, and they're talking about Congress, shall in each of these cases regulate the number of representatives of the number of inhabitants according to the provisions hereafter made at the ratio of 1 for every 40,000. So in other words, that number right there, or that line right there in the Constitution, is maintaining Congress's control over the apportionment of representation for each of the houses. They're not saying that they're going to diminish or anything else. And then we jump down to the next admission of new states, which is on page 258, which is a couple pages down. And this is what Mr. Rutledge says then on the admission of new states. This is Article 12. New states lawfully constituted or established within the limits of the United States may be admitted by the legislature, in other words, by Congress, into this government. But to such admission, the consent of 2/3 of the members present in each house shall be necessary. If a new state shall arise within the limits of any of the present states, the consent of the legislatures of each state shall be also necessary to its admission. If the admission is to be consented to, the new state shall be admitted on the same terms with the original states, but the legislature may make conditions, in other words, Congress may make conditions with new states concerning the public debt, which shall be then subsisting. Okay, so this right here, by the way, folks, this is highlighted special, and I'm doing it right now. And this is the reason why, is this comes up in Congress, when they're talking about the Assumption Act, that it was brokered in the Constitutional Convention that the states would actually have to assume the debts of the federal government as well as the other states and so forth. And so this is where the language kind of was included in the Constitution that they would do that. And that bottom line, as Madison points out, it was abandoned because it was considered too onerous, and it was it would fail the uniformity test. In other words, certain states would bear a greater burden than other states. There's no way you could make it uniform. So it became very problematic to implement and to maintain. Therefore, they abandoned it. So that being said, with Article 17, Article 18, the United States shall guarantee to each state a republican form of government and shall protect each state against foreign invasions and on the application of the legislature against domestic violence. Okay. So with that, they continue going through the Constitution. And by, shortly, because they're pretty close to the end of going through it at that point. And therefore, the next real time that we, have any headway in some discussions is actually on page 264. And so now we're jumping again. We're really jumping because I'm bypassing, like I said before, we're jumping over the electors and the points of the electors because the Electoral College has been completely abandoned. It was bastardized right out the gate, even though the ratification debates really clarified this. And we've covered this before. What I'm really trying to, harp on is this representation so that we can start understanding the importance of our Republican form of government, as well as the apportionment, as well as the admission of new states. How did this union grow? Did the union grow outside the boundaries of the United States? Technically, no, and partially, yes. Technically, no. Congress has the authority to admitting new states into the union. They do not have the authority to state hard requirements upon those states. So when they started basically forcing new states to add things into their constitution, that was overreach by Congress, which basically means that every state that joined the union after Indiana and beyond, all those states need to really redo their constitutions by going into a convention. So with this, when we come back, because we're basically at the end of the show, when we come back, we'll start off with the property and representation, again, this key problem that Congress is still wrestling with, and we're looking at, what is this, August 7th. Is that the 7th? Yeah. So this is August 7th. They're still wrestling with this. And so we'll dive into this when we come back, because this, I think, is where they start turning the corner and making some significant changes to those specific languages I've been highlighting. So, folks, as I always say, this is Reclaiming the Republic. I'm G.R. Mobley, and we're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. Sorry for messing that up.
Listen to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.